Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact.
So the fossil fuel industry has kind of got the world enthralled. Renewable energy, in my view, is going to break through that and liberate a lot of poor countries from the shackles of the fossil fuel industry.
My guest today is Mark Campanale. Mark has worked for over 25 years in sustainable financial markets and is co-founder of some of the first responsible investment funds. Mark is the founder of the Carbon Tracker Initiative, which won the Guardian Sustainable Business Award for innovation. He also founded Planet Tracker, a financial think tank focused on fisheries and land use change. In 2018, London's Evening Standard named Mark as one of the 1,000 most influential people in London. And much more importantly, Mark is a founding member of The Conduit. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Paul.
So you've spent the better part of your adult life working on questions of sustainability. Some may say way ahead of your time. Tell us a little bit of what led you down that path. Where did you first see the light? When did you get the spark of inspiration?
Gosh, you know, I don't get asked that question that often. Now let me just roll back a bit. So to understand a little bit about me, my family's from southern Italy, from Puglia, right down in the south, and we were traditionally olive farmers. And my heart is very much in the land and has been through, you know, many generations. And so I had an interest in how the world is and the influences on it. And probably coming to the UK, my father was a bit of an outsider. And growing up in London, probably felt a bit of an outsider. And I got fascinated very quickly about the business world and the finance world. And I thought, wow, you know, whoever's working in that can have a profound influence on the world around us. But my family is also a bit of a radical family, tradition of which continues through the generations. Paul, you got to meet my kids, of disruption, of looking at justice as an issue. And also probably, though I'm not a big C Catholic, but definitely Catholic teachings about equality and justice and also fighting oppression. And sometimes these things you just carry on with you through your life. And so it did from the beginning. And so quite early on, I got involved in a development charity. That opened my eyes, well, even more than to an extent than I thought that they were open. And that probably was those series of things bringing them together brought me into where I am today, into how I think about the world, how I look at the world. And obviously, I can't forget my mother, who was also born into a bit of a radical family. We used to joke, she used to date the young Communist Party of Great Britain in the 50s before she met my father, who came from a family of communists. So quite a nice match, actually. And a little bit of all of that has rubbed off on me and is still with me now.
Well, usually, you know, people have one or two sources of inspiration that put them on a path of positive social change. You have half a dozen. So it seems almost preordained that you would get there.
Yeah, though of course it could have gone in a very different direction. And, you know, so I think opportunities were thrown up. Some of them have been thrown away. Some of them are grabbed with both hands. And the chance to go into finance. I trained as an agricultural economist after leaving university. And I thought that I was going to be working in East Africa or West Africa. So I traveled and around that part of the world. I was one of the first kind of people to work as an analyst to what is best known now as Band-Aid, Live Aid. But at that time, there was a series of analysts that were helping them out. I'm talking 1986, 87. And so I went out and worked in Kenya and Tanzania. And I really thought I was going to be an agricultural economist. I got very, very unwell. I came back came out of the UK. And through that, I met an amazing woman, sadly not with us anymore, called Tessa Tennant. And this is back end of 1988, 89. And I got a role as one of the first, well, I think I probably was the second green investment analyst in the City of London. Just spent all my time analyzing the world from a sustainability perspective, and became the first sort of founders of the first of these ecological funds that were set up. We're talking 30 years ago now, Paul, not 25 years ago, so 30 years ago, and I've stayed with it since.
So you could have been in a life of sort of not-for-profits or charities or activism or a lobbyist, but you sort of gravitated into finance and have, you know, stayed with that ever since. What drew you to finance? Was it pure chance? Did you just get a job and stumble into it, or did you make a more conscious decision?
No, it was a bit of a conscious decision, plus opportunity, to be honest with you. Working in the philanthropy side of things in the late 80s, the non-profit sector, and looking at business, business could be either a force for good or for bad. And I in those years, I worked for the Schluter family. So the uncle of James Perry, which I think is a member here. And they were the first involved in fair trade coffee. And so I was working briefly for the Kilimanjaro Native Cooperative Union through a African business that the Schluters were involved in, doing fair trade coffee. And I thought, well, actually, if we can promote more fair business and equal trade, then maybe we can move away from the pure philanthropic model versus the pure business-only profit-maximizing model. So that made me think. And then the other thing that caught my eye, and there's some pictures of me. The first Stop the City demonstrations in the City of London around those years, 85, 86, 87. Do you remember them?
I was in diapers.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I'm kidding, of course.
So I thought, well, if we could put people with goodwill into very influential positions of responsibility in finance, then maybe we can extend the sword of justice into the heart of finance and the business community, and actually mobilize the capital that was needed in some of these developing countries that I was working in, bringing that capital to work, but in producing the food and agriculture and so on that I was professionally very interested in. But so that was such an important revelation, but also that the city, if you think about it, maybe around the world, just a couple of dozen bankers make decisions which influence the lives of millions and millions of people. Let's try and influence those bankers to do good things. And that's probably been my journey the last 30 years, is really focusing on just that, power to change things for good.
So the first ecological fund 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You're now involved in many many funds today that might be, you know, similarly styled. Mm. Tell us about that fund and how is it different from where we've got to today?
Ah, so we're talking about what was then called the Merlin Ecology Fund, and it's now known as the Jupiter Ecology Fund, which is still around 30 years on. I think it's got about £580 million in it. When I got involved in it, it was still just under 10 million in size. And it was doing two things. It was buying small listed companies internationally that were doing water and recycling and waste and energy conservation. The other thing they were doing was small private equity deals with what is essentially a public markets fund. So we invested in some seafood farms in Norway. We invested in some private forestry in Wales. We invested in some fuel, a technology to remove emissions from power stations called Fuel Tech. So quite innovative. It was run by a guy called Derek Charles, who's, again, sadly not with us. And I was one of the analysts, and we had so much fun doing it together, working together as a team. And it's different from today. We've all been reading about the unfortunate situation with Neil Woodford, who bought private companies with a public markets fund. So a lot of things we're doing 30 years ago are not seen as good practice now. So where we are today, I think the public market funds investing in publicly traded companies doing energy conservation and wind and renewables and so on is well accepted. And there's probably now than at any time an interest in investing in private companies involved in the sustainability space. So the world's moved on a long way, still much more to do. That first fund, the what is now called the Jupiter Ecology Fund, has survived and has thrived. And I think I'm right in saying it's beaten the market overall over those 30 years. So it hasn't done too badly. And the world of finance is now much more comfortable with the idea of having an analyst working, doing sustainability. Then it was almost unheard of. People didn't understand the job that I used to do. They couldn't understand why I was an investor interested in environment. But now I think every major financial institution has a team of 15 or 20 people just doing nothing but sustainability. So in that sense, the world has been transformed.
So let's leapfrog into Carbon Tracker. Mm. Tell us what Carbon Tracker does.
So we're a non-profit financial think tank, and all we do is provide data and analysis on the fossil fuel industry for their biggest shareholders and for financial market regulators and people like accountants. Our goal is to transform the energy system and the way the financial community looks at climate change. Basically to get people out of fossil fuels and into renewables by exposing the risks and to extend the opportunities by making them understand the bitter risks that the world faces from continuing to rely on fossil fuels. So we're data-driven, but with a little bit of advocacy because we want to see finance get out of fossil fuels. And we have offices in London and New York. There's now, off the back of a small idea, there's now 27 of us. And we work internationally with the investment community, well supported by some great philanthropies like KR Foundation and Grantham Foundation and Bloomberg Philanthropies. And every day we're around somewhere around the world working with investors, trying to unravel a coal-fired power station or unpick an oil project or look at the risks involved with gas. Got to get the word out of fossil fuels.
And so how do you specifically do that? I mean, on one level, I think everybody now, perhaps not as much as 5 or 10 or certainly 15 years ago, recognizes the incredible threat of coal and carbon. Mm. But what do you do that others don't that makes that danger more visible?
Yeah, so what we're best known for doing is doing a very simple piece of maths. We took the world's top 200 coal, oil and gas companies. We looked at the reserves that they own. So how much reserves of oil or coal have they got underground? We then said, well, what would happen to the world's warming if we were to release all the carbon dioxide tied up into their reserves? And the answer is that there's about 7 times more proven fossil fuels, such as coal and oil, than we can possibly burn to stay below 2 degrees. So we called that unburnable carbon, and we asked the question, are financial markets carrying a carbon bubble? Because the public companies like the Shell and the Exxons and the Glencores already own far more fossil fuels than we can possibly ever burn. And so we said, well, look, maybe these reserves will become financially stranded. And so our second report on wasted capital, which says if you can't burn what the fossil fuels you already own, why are you spending more money going to find more? And so our wasted capital and stranded assets link this word stranded assets to the fossil fuel industry for the first time. And then we wrote this to the financial market regulators. So I was invited to present my analysis to the Financial Stability Board of the G20, which, you know, is Mark Carney's, was chairing it. So I had to present to all these central bankers over at the Bank of England. And then a few months later, Mark Carney gave his unburnable carbon speech, essentially echoing the same message about the risks of climate change to financial stability. And that transformed things. Something then else happened which we weren't expecting was an American called Bill McKibben. Now, Bill McKibben is a great scientist, understander of the science, but campaigner. He was one of the people involved in setting up 350.org. And he read our article, our first article, and the other founder, Nick Robbins, and I, we'd only published 100 copies of this report. Naomi Klein gave a copy of this report to Bill McKibben, and Bill then wrote his famous article in Rolling Stone magazine called Global Warming's Terrifying New Maths, where he ran through our analysis and said the world must divest from fossil fuels. And no one had really said that before until Bill had really put his arms around it and the campaigners from the students around America and launched the divestment movement. Now, this went around the world like wildfire. Lord Stern wrote an article about us in the Financial Times very quickly afterwards, talking about stranded assets. And then together, these two and three things, actually, Mark Carney in the Bank of England, Bill McKibben with the divestment movement, and then rational financial market commentators like Lord Stern. Those three factors came together and interest just exploded. And we were asked to present all around the world to financial regulators and to investment banks and pension funds. And today there's about $8 trillion have announced their divestment from coal, oil and gas, and it's growing every day. People getting out of fossil fuels. So very unexpected, Paul. Wasn't in my life plan at the time, but been quite amazing.
So explain to those of us who don't know the exact mechanics. You're a coal or an oil company. You're throwing off a bunch of cash.
Yeah.
You want to continue to exploit those resources and discover new resources. Investors start taking money out of your company in publicly traded markets. The stock price goes down, but you're still getting the cash, which enables you to explore from the sale of your carbon asset. So explain the link between how divestment will actually stop the exploitation of these assets for those for whom this might not be clear.
Yeah, now the divestment movement is really an ethical and moral movement in many respects. It's saying, look, if we're a foundation or a church or another group that has an ethical reason not to own shares, that's a very valid reason. Now, whilst the companies are making money today, the cash that they pay out in the form of dividends, a lot of that's come from bank borrowings. They're making less money than they were in the past. Oil prices have not recovered to above $100 a barrel that we've seen in previous years. With the rise of the electric vehicle, we see demand for oil chipping away. And in turn, a new technology like the electric vehicle will very soon be cheaper to buy and to run and operate than the traditional internal combustion engine. So you've got an industry, the oil industry, hanging on to essentially a dying technology, the internal combustion engine, and investors are waking up and realizing that. So the second reason why things have changed is investors no longer believe in the business model of the oil industry. And that poses a question, which is the industry is forecasting 25% growth over the next couple of decades in demand for oil, as if the electric vehicle has never existed or hasn't been designed. And the question is, why are you using scarce capital to go in and expand production when you should be consolidating and probably beginning a transformation program? So growing numbers of investors no longer believe that it's possible to grow the fossil fuel industry, either because of technology or because of policy. A potential for a carbon price, a potential for tougher regulation, and what some of my colleagues call an inevitable policy response. Now, what do they mean by that? 10 years' time, extreme weather events. We're just reading today about storms across France destroying crops. You've got extreme weather in India, very high temperatures. You've got these weather extremes happening across the world. So maybe policy will cut in. Governments will say, we're going to close down coal-fired power stations. We're going to ban the production of oil. And that actually one of those is going to catch people out. The idea that governments and citizens will sit around over the next 20 years, allowing the fossil fuel industry to do whatever it likes, as if there is no link, is not going to work. Extinction Rebellion and campaigns like that are making the public ever more aware. So investors have put a big question mark over the future of the sector.
So if on the one hand markets are going to push these companies either out of business or make it more difficult for them to raise and deploy capital, if governments are going to subject them to increased regulatory scrutiny, and if we had 50 years for this to work its way through, I would be fairly confident. I think the trick is, as we both know, that we have 5 or 10 years, not 50 years.
Yeah.
And so the question I have for you is, will markets and government be enough to get the fossil fuel industry to change with the speed that we need it to change in order to be beneath 2 or even 1.5 degrees?
I wish the answer was yes, but I'm afraid the answer is no. We don't have enough time. Markets and government will not be enough. We're going to have to think about this again. Look, the problem with climate change principally but not exclusively comes from the burning of fossil fuels. It comes elsewhere, we know, from methane production from animals and so on, but actually principally comes from burning fossil fuels. Now, you can deal with this in 2 ways. You can say to everyone, stop using fossil fuels. It's one way of doing it. You impose a carbon price to make it more expensive. You tell citizens to turn the light off or walk to work. But these are the actions of millions and billions of people, which are going to be too small and too late. The other way of looking at it, and this is how I look at it, is you say, well, if we can't control the demand for fossil fuels, we can control the supply. So I set up Carbon Tracker really as an attempt to say, let's constrain the supply. We know the top 200 governments and corporates like the Exxons that are producing the fossil fuels. Let's put in place a new treaty, a global treaty, that says we will not produce more fossil fuels than we can use that will take us above 1.5 degrees. So we put a constraint over the production. So some of us have talked more about this and have written about this. So my good friends Zipporah Berman in Canada and Andrew Sims here in the UK have written the idea of a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, a global treaty, a bit similar to a nuclear treaty, but based on the idea of, in the same way you don't produce too many nuclear weapons, which was the whole basis of the treaty in the 70s, we do the same with fossil fuels. We agree an international treaty to say, let's stop the production of oil and coal and gas. I quite like that idea, and it will bring governments and policymakers and corporates together to start to begin to discuss how we can keep fossil fuels in the ground.
Tell us a little bit about your recent trip to the Vatican. That you and a group of oil company and coal company CEOs went to visit the Pope, and I'm imagining there must have been a series of fascinating conversations between and amongst that group.
There was. So the genesis of this was I had the pleasure to meet Professor Leo Burke from the University of Notre Dame in America, and Carolyn, a woman he works with, and they came to London about 3 or 4 years ago. We were talking around some ideas, and they had, I think, this idea of, let's see if we can bring companies involved in producing oil and gas together. The bit that I added was, if we do that, why don't we bring investors? Let's bring their biggest shareholders together. And out of that developed the idea of a dialogue between investors, the Vatican, and the oil and gas sector. And we all met for the first time last year, probably maybe about 20, 25 of us. And then this year, the group was much bigger. We met, in fact, just the last couple of days. I came back on Friday night, and today's Monday, and there was probably around 40. So there wasn't a single oil and gas company that you've heard of that wasn't in the room, and plus the world's biggest investors. The list of those names is supposed to be confidential, but you can find it on the internet. The world's biggest investors. And we sat around with a cardinal, and we had a scientist, and we had a few ex-political energy leaders, and then Carbon Tracker and myself representing the environmental community. And we produced an agreement or a statement around a global carbon price, and we also agreed together what companies would disclose to their shareholders about how they're transforming their businesses because of climate risk. I didn't think we were going to get anything signed, to be honest with you. I was amazed how, through the leadership of a couple of chief execs of these oil companies in particular, we got to sign this statement. Now, does this mean they're getting out of the fossil fuel industry? No. Does it mean that they together acknowledge the role of burning oil and gas in contributing to climate change? Yes. Even the big American companies, the ones that we hear about in the papers, they even accepted it. And with the leadership of Pope Francis, who was there in the room, who addressed us, who called for us to keep to 1.5 degrees of warming, together that was a profound and very moving moment.
And do you think that that is likely to lead to an actual change in behavior? Because, you know, the cynic will say, you get to hang out with the Pope, you get your photograph taken, you burnish your credentials, it's a wonderful PR moment, and then you carry on business as usual in a circumstance where we're all at existential risk.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think it's all the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? Let's see what they do. The only thing I can say is that there was goodwill in the room. I didn't get the sense they were trying to approach this cynically or skeptically. I think that there was a real common consensus in the room. But, you know, this is only part of the picture. You've got investors challenging these companies every day. I've got in my team, my colleagues are 25. This is all we do, day in, day out, have done for the last 7 years. We're pushing on with our allies in the financial community. We're continuing to ask the questions every day of these companies. So the heat isn't going away. We just have to make sure that the outputs, what they produce, has relevance and can actually indicate that they're really moving on. There's this global initiative, and Anne Simpson, the chair of it, was actually with me at the Vatican, called Climate Action 100. It's a coalition of $34 trillion of investor money that she chairs, that is trying to call out the world's top 200 polluters, many of whom were in that meeting room at the Vatican. And afterwards, we talked about it and said, look, you know, we have to push on. We have to keep making sure the companies are kept to account. Because if they're not, I can see the heat's going to turn up against the companies. They've been given plenty of chances, and there's a lot of patience. But people are showing signs of impatience. And the people that the oil and gas companies are dealing with are taking it very seriously. I'm talking their top five shareholders are taking this very seriously. And they're not going to be fooled. I mean, these are people controlling trillions of dollars of capital. There were three people in that room. Just the three of them alone controlled about $14 trillion just between the three of them. Now, you don't want to make enemies of them if you're running a company, because they're going to walk away.
So if wind and solar and battery storage and smart grids are going to get us to a market-driven solution to decarbonizing in many of the countries in the world, you and I both know that India and China and other parts of Asia have a whole bunch of fully amortized coal production plants that are running basically for free or close thereto. And there isn't really, absent a massive carbon tax, an economic rationale to shut them down. They're just generating pretty cheap power. What do we do with that kind of present threat where a market solution doesn't seem, at least in the short term, viable?
Yeah, so if you've got a country which has its own fossil fuel assets and is using them for power, and they can do it cheaply, you can see why we've got a problem. You know, China has its resources, India does, South Africa does, but not in all parts of the world can they actually operate that technology efficiently. So we know South Africa has abundant resources of coal. They just can't make any money out of those out of their coal-fired power in South Africa, as you probably know, Paul. India's a slightly different situation. Carbon Tracker, our analysis, and we've just got a grant from Google.org to use satellites to monitor coal-fired power stations around the world. We're modeling the economics of every coal-fired power station in the world. If you go to carbontracker.org, you can have a look at how we do this analysis. And we estimate that it's cheaper today to close down your coal and use new renewable energy in about 35% of the world's coal production. It's not 65%, it's 35%. It's still significant. We can just start to remove the coal-fired capacity that we don't need. The other thing that you've got to bear in mind is that the other half of the world that doesn't have fossil fuel assets, about 4/5 of the world's population lives in energy-importing countries. they have to import their energy from another place. So the Philippines imports it from Indonesia. Japan imports it from Indonesia and elsewhere. Australia, huge exporter of coal. Now, if you can produce your own energy, electric energy from the sun or from the wind, for the 4/5 of the world's population, they're going to be so much better switching to renewables because they're not going to be dependent on another country. Look at the countries which we spend billions of dollars of cash to. They're, you know, the Middle East, the countries like Venezuela, the Irans and the Iraqs. These aren't great countries. They're not democratic countries. So the fossil fuel industry has kind of got the world enthralled. Renewable energy, in my view, is going to break through that and liberate a lot of poor countries from the shackles of the fossil fuel industry.
Let's turn to fish.
Ah.
In amongst the many things you've done, you've also done something on called Fish Tracker. Mm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Paul. Talking about climate change, it can be a bit gloomy, can't it? I mean, I'm not a gloomy person by any means. The fish situation, unlike climate change, which once you've gone over a threshold, is irreversible. In the case of fisheries, unless you've really bust a fisheries, you can actually restore and regenerate your fisheries. But what we discovered at Fish Tracker, which is part of this bigger group, Planet Tracker, and we're going to be looking at agriculture and water and plastics and textiles and so on. It's something which we didn't know is that there's over 200 stock exchange listed fisheries companies. Now, what does that mean? It means when we read about overfishing in the oceans, it could be that there are fishing companies in your pension fund that you own that are doing this. No one had really looked at it before. And we discovered 228 companies, fisheries companies or aquaculture companies on stock exchanges, including a Chinese fishing company on the London Stock Exchange, which came as a bit of a surprise to people. So we went away and said, okay, what's going on? Where do they fish? How do they fish? Where is the overfishing happening? And we found that in many areas, the collapsing fish stock is linked to these large conglomerates and large fish and food processing companies, many of which will be in people's pension funds. And that started a new research campaign to find out the links between the destruction that we see in nature and how financial markets operate. So we now have a great team based here at the Conduit. There's eight of them. And we're getting ready to launch a big new report looking at Asian fish and looking at overfishing across Asia and looking at the role of ordinary investors in financing the destruction of the oceans.
So fisheries is a potentially good news story. If we stop overfishing and fish sustainably, you can actually return the bounty of the oceans in a way that serves communities and is sustainable. Yeah. I know you've also done some work historically on forests. Give us your views on that as a both a dwindling but also potentially a renewable resource.
Yeah, gosh. Could we have done something but didn't do something when we had the chance? So in 90, would have been, what year would it have been? 94, I went to a very nice lunch. They do nice lunches here, Paul. But I went to a very nice lunch at the Savoy. And it was a industrial logging company that was clearing large areas of forest in Indonesia, essentially to plant for palm oil. And they were looking to raise £300 million out of London. I think they did it. And they weren't the only one. There was a whole series of these companies coming through. And that was what got me, again, re-emphasizing the idea about linking whether it's overfishing or deforestation to the role of what we do here in London. And I desperately wanted to investigate this. So about 30 or 40 companies that are stock exchange listed or well known that are involved in the deforestation across Asia for palm oil. And I think, so I'm talking, this was in the 1995, 96, 97. Did we miss a chance to stop it? I think we may have done, and I feel something very passionate about. Met much of the battle, I'm afraid, on stopping deforestation has been lost because so much forest has been converted to palm oil. But what we can do is protect what we have and stop forest encroachment, whether it's for palm oil or for beef or for soy production across the Amazon. I've been proud to have been the treasurer of the Rainforest Foundation UK for the last 10 years or so. And what they've done, and I think this is absolutely right, they've supported the rights of indigenous peoples in forests. People, communities live in forests, they're great protectors of the forests, and they've developed a program called mappingforrights.org, which gives indigenous peoples like an iPad, or where they can designate, and they use satellites to designate traditional lands that have been with the tribe or the family for many generations, and then they map it. And then they have some basis to protect and defend against people encroaching on it, whether it's logging companies or mining companies or oil prospecting companies. And we have to defend the rights of people living in forests.
So you've worked on carbon, on fish, on forests, and you've sought to call out those people who are not using those resources in a sustainable way. Mm. The flip side also is that you need an entire ecosystem of entrepreneurs and innovators who produce the solutions once you've called out the bad actors. And
Yeah. You're
a founding member of The Conduit. You have your offices here. There's a network of close to 3,000 people who are members. Swimming in that sea, as it were, are you optimistic that there is an entrepreneurial movement that is emerging that is equal to the task?
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. I mean, I have remained committed and interested as an investor, where I can backing enterprises, and every day I see a new idea or a company or a fund that's trying to do something different in the sustainability space. The Conduit is a thriving network of organizations and individuals working and swimming in the same direction. I find many allies here and people I've worked with over the years. And are we up to the task? You bet we're up to the task. Time is against us, but there's humanity has great creativity. And I think people with goodwill, like you find here, working together, I think we can probably give it a good go.
I think that's a wonderful note on which to end. I think on behalf of all of us, we're enormously grateful for your 30-year-plus work in this field, and I suspect you have another 30 to go. And thank you so much for joining us on Conduit Conversations.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, The Conduit.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you will find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.